This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back to the third hour of our program. This is the rant. I want to share with you some thoughts here that I was going to open the show with, but the hearings were on, you know, in process, and we got right into them. And then I thought, well, I'll open the second hour with this. But then we had, you know, the executive vice president of Planned Parenthood on. And then so here I've got a few minutes. I just want to share this with you, and I would love to get your response to my thoughts on this. It seems to me, looking at the arc of history in the United States, it seems to me that when the Supreme Court is substantially out of step with the American people, that it provokes a crisis of governance. And that in the case of, in 1935, when the Supreme Court, this was still essentially the Lochner Court. This was the Supreme Court that was knocking down everything that FDR was trying to do. And they struck down the National Industrial Recovery Act in late 1935. And that law provided for minimum wage, maximum hours, workplace safety, the right to unionize, the end of child labor. They struck it all down, the Supreme Court. And that provoked this huge crisis. FDR ran for re-election in 36. He won in an absolute landslide. And in 37, after he was sworn into office, he came back and he said, okay, that's it for the Supreme Court. If these guys don't start ruling my way, I am going to introduce legislation to expand the number of members of the court to as many as 15. Every justice over 70, at that point in time, six of the nine justices at that point in time were over 70 years old. Every justice over 70 would get a co-justice that FDR would appoint who would vote on behalf of that person over 70. They would be essentially justices emeritus if they chose not to retire. So the court could go as big as 15 people. It would still only have nine votes. And this was FDR's plan. And he probably would have passed. And he was dead serious about it. And so what happened was that, and the reason why FDR decided that this was a battle really worth fighting was that the two pieces of legislation, the Social Security Act of 1935 and the Wagner Act of 1935, the National Labor Relations Act, that created the NLRB and the Department of Labor, these two pieces of legislation were going to the Supreme Court in 37. And the court was going to knock them down. They were going to declare that Social Security was unconstitutional, that the right to unionize was unconstitutional. And they flipped. Under pressure from FDR, they flipped. There wasn't anybody got added to the court, nobody left the court, but they just, two of the justices said, okay, we're going to go along with FDR, rather than have a crisis. Now, the time before that, when it got really bad, was about 80 years before that, which goes back to kind of, you know, Strauss and Howe's theory that every 80 years we have basically a revolution in America. And that was in 1856, as I recall, maybe 57. And in that case, Roger Taney, it's spelled like it's Tanny, T-A-N-N-E-Y, but it was pronounced Taney. Roger Taney was the Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court. He was a Southerner. I believe he was from Tennessee. And he wanted to solve, in quotes, the problem of slavery, in quotes. And so when Mr. Dred Scott came before him and said that he had lived four years, outside of the slave states, he had been in Illinois and someplace else, maybe Missouri, and actually couldn't because of the Missouri Compromise. But in any case, that he had lived 4 years in a non-slave state and therefore he should be freed from Mr. Sanford, who was his owner. And in the Dred Scott case, Roger Taney ruled that, nope, sorry, slavery, you know, we're going to extend slavery basically to the entire United States. And Abraham Lincoln campaigned on not following Taney's advice. And Abraham Lincoln refused to go along with that Supreme Court decision. And that split the nation. Not Lincoln's response, but Taney's decision split the nation in a way that provoked the Civil War. and 600,000 Americans died because the Supreme Court was out of sync with where the American people were at. I'm watching a dynamic right now where the American body politic is moving progressive faster than I can recall any time in my lifetime. I'm guessing that this is probably what people were experiencing in 1933 when Franklin Roosevelt was elected after you know three years of Herbert Hoover doing basically nothing to stop the Great Depression. It just got worse and worse and worse. The day that FDR was sworn into office, all that week, the final banks in America failed. All the banks in America had failed. And they took everybody's savings with them after they foreclosed on everything they could. It wiped out the American middle class. The banksters got off just fine, but the middle class was screwed. And America said, that's it. We want to go progressive. And the Supreme Court didn't until 37. It was 4 years later. And it was a crisis for this country. And I see the same kind of crisis playing out right now, particularly, I mean, it's already happening, but there's been very little publicity to it. I mean, Sheldon Whitehouse this morning pointing out 73 decisions where the Roberts, 73 5-4 decisions where the Roberts Five, the five right-wing Republicans on the court, ruled in favor of white men, in favor of big business, in favor of billionaires, against people of color, against women, against the working class. 74 decisions, or 73, excuse me, decisions by the Roberts Five. And so it's already happening. But I think it's been so incremental. It's been this decision, then this decision, then this decision, then this decision. It's sort of, you know, the stuff that when I'm quoting from They Thought They Were Free, it's kind of that kind of same kind of stuff that the Germans were telling Milton Mayer about in late 1940s, where, you know, yeah, you know, if Hitler had started gassing people the week after Kristallnacht, we all would have been up in arms, or the week after the German firm signs appeared in the windows in 1934. But it didn't happen like that. There were a million little tiny steps in between. And that's what we're getting. And Kavanaugh's nomination, in a very real way, is making this all visible to us. I think it's waking the country up. I think the Trump presidency is waking the country up. For better or worse, we're getting the Susan Sarandon scenario. Right? You get Trump in there, and everybody will see how friggin' crazy he is and the entire Republican Party has become. They will see how corrupt the Republican Party has become. They'll see how the billionaires own the game to the point that they can get these legislators to write them $1.5 trillion tax cut. The people will see that and they'll say, enough of that. We're not going back. We're not voting Republican anymore. So that's the way that it could play out. And I think it is playing out right now. Bob Woodward's new book is another big piece of this, Fear. And it's a book about how there's basically an insane, deranged man in the White House. Which, by the way, if you haven't watched Downfall, which is a German, it's a movie in German, German-made movie in German with English subtitles of Hitler's last days. And the young man who brought Hitler the information that he was dying, his name was Armin Lehmann. And Armin was a dear friend of mine. Armin and I taught seminars in the travel industry back in the 80s all over the world. And I kept track, you know, kept up with Armin, and Armin moved to Oregon, and Armin wrote an autobiography about, he was the courier, it was titled Hitler's Last Courier. He was the guy who delivered the news to Hitler that the war was lost. He stepped out of the room and Hitler committed suicide. Armin was there, he was 15 years old. Armin just died a couple of years ago. But hearing Armin's stories about what Hitler was like, and then reading Bob Woodward's book, or the excerpts that I've read on the Washington Post, from his new book, Fear, about what Trump is like the weirdest deja vu. And the German people did not have an opportunity to know that Hitler was nuts. Or the Spaniards with Franco, or the Italians with Mussolini. They just saw the patina. They just saw the surface, you know, just the coating. But now we've got people inside the White House speaking to reporters like Bob Woodward saying, yeah, the guy is nuts and incompetent, and he has the intellect of a fifth grader. Now, the question in my mind is, did he always have the intellect of a fifth grader, or is he losing it? But when this, but the bottom line here, the net of what I'm saying, is I see a crisis coming. A crisis that in the past has actually provoked a civil war in this country. A crisis produced by the Supreme Court using judicial review, using the power to strike down laws or to create laws, which Taney arguably did in Dred Scott, leading to a civil war. I see a similar crisis coming. And a crisis that could be the beginning of a renewal of our country. In fact, I think that's the most likely outcome, although we're going to go through a period of pain. I think the backside of this is going to be very, very good, because Americans are waking up and we do have core values and they are instilled in us. Although, you know, since the Reagan era, they've been cutting civics out of the classrooms aggressively. Bill Bennett, as the education secretary, started that process. Bill Bennett, this is the 360, Sean. Bill Bennett, who famously said, this is the Secretary of Education under Ronald Reagan. This is what he had to say.
But I do know that it's true that if you wanted to reduce crime, you could, if that were your sole purpose, you could abort every black baby in this country and your crime rate would go down. That would be an impossible, ridiculous, and morally reprehensible thing to do. But your crime rate would go down.
See, that's how they talked in the Reagan White House. I mean, you know, we're not that far away from this, right? But, you know, Bill Bennett killing off civics in our schools, and now, you know, do we have an educated populace? I am hopeful that we do. I'm actually optimistic. I think the majority of Americans are awake to what's going on. They have figured out the games these guys are playing, and they're not going to put up with it anymore. And I think that we're going to see that in the ballots in November. Republican voter suppression notwithstanding, that's the wild card, is will they be able to suppress enough votes, like they did in 2000? Will they be able to suppress enough votes to prevent a Democratic wave?
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
So that's my theory. Those are my thoughts. Your thoughts on my thoughts and other news of the day after this. And stick around. We'll be right back.
Level, whose integrity he has questioned.
Here we go.
And
back to the hearings.
Your responses to our questions will be highly enlightening about whether you join us in defending the judiciary and the rule of law. That very president has nominated you in this unprecedented time. Unprecedented because he is an unindicted co-conspirator who has nominated a potential justice who will cast the swing vote on issues relating to his possible criminal culpability. In fact, whether he is required to obey a subpoena to appear before a grand jury, whether he is required to testify in a prosecution of his friends or associates or other officials in his administration, and whether, in fact, he is required to stand trial if he is indicted while he is President of the United States. There is a basic principle of our Constitution, and it was articulated by the founders. No one can select a judge in his own case. That's what the President is potentially doing here, selecting a justice on the Supreme Court who potentially will cast a decisive vote in his own case. That is a reason why this proceeding is so consequential. Senator Sass urged us to do our job. I agree. Part of our job is to review the record of the nominee as thoroughly and deliberately as possible, looking to all the relevant and probative evidence. We can't do that on this record. Mr. Chairman, You have said multiple times that your staff has already reviewed the 42,000 pages of documents produced to this committee at 5:41 p.m. yesterday. Both sides are using the same computer platform to review the documents from Mr. Burke. The documents had to be loaded into this platform overnight and couldn't be concluded until 6:45 a.m. this morning. How is it possible that your staff concluded its review last night before the documents were even uploaded? That's this platform that both sides are using here. Simply not possible, Mr. Chairman, that any senator has seen these new materials, much less all of the other relevant documents that have been screened by Bill Burke, who is not the National Archivist. And this situation, when we say it's unprecedented, is truly without parallel in our history. And I'm going to quote from the National Archivist. It's, quote, something that has never happened before. And the archivist continued, this effort by former President Bush does not represent the National Archives or the George W. Bush Presidential Library.
Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut will be right back.
Mr. Chairman, I renew my motion to adjourn so that we have...
Yeah, there we go. Thank you. Welcome back. Senator Richard Blumenthal of Connecticut has just asked that that they go into recess. He pointed out that the 40-some-odd thousand documents were only available to them as of 6 o'clock this morning, and this hearing started at 9:30 this morning. So he's asking for a break. In fact, maybe we can bring it up for just a minute and see what they're talking about.
Those rules apply to executive business session. We're not in an executive business session. So I deny your
Mr. Chairman, with all due respect, I ask you to point to me the language in Rule 4 or anywhere else in our rules that limits its scope to executive business meetings. There is no such language, Mr. Chairman.
I would have you
quote calling out to the Grassley.
To the contrary.
Could you quote me that language?
No, I'm asking you. You quote me a language to the contrary of what I ruled.
There is no language to the contrary. I'm asking for a vote in this session now. There's nothing to...
So what's going on here? I'll tell you what's going on. You can back it off a little bit, Sean, but you can let it go in the background so I can keep track of what's going on. I can talk and listen at the same time. What's going on here is Richard Burr is saying we need to have an adjournment, right? We need to have a pause in this process. And Rule 4 of the way that the Senate conducts its business, or at least this committee conducts its business, Rule 4 says that if a member asks for a break and there is a majority on the committee who say, yeah, let's take the break, then you get the break. Now, there are two Republicans who are not here this morning for the hearings. One of them is Lindsey Graham. I'm drawing a blank. I am not remembering who the other one is. But there's two Republicans who are not there. So if Grassley allowed there to be a vote, the Democrats have a majority on the Senate Judiciary Committee right now. They would vote for a delay. And Grassley, you know, the orders that he's been given by the billionaire funders of the Republican Party is, we want this guy on the Supreme Court. He's going to cover our butts. And, you know, you will not delay this. And so, you know, Blumenthal is saying, I want the delay. The Rule 4 says I can have the delay. Grassley says, no, Rule 4 only applies to executive session when we're meeting in secret. And Blumenthal is like, read me that language. Show me where it says that. And Grassley says, well, you show me where it doesn't say that. Which is bizarre, right? It's like, you know, there's a bird in the sky. No, there's not. I don't see the bird. Well, show me that there's not a bird. I mean, it's really? This is so bizarre. This is like Alice in Wonderland. I'll pick up your phone calls after this. A lot of people want to get in this conversation about the Supreme Court as well. 27 minutes past the hour. Boy, it's getting interesting. Stick around.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
be right back. Stick around. Welcome back. It's 34 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. We've been listening to Richard Blumenthal. He's talking to Brett Kavanaugh, saying basically, do you want to be the guy who's got the asterisk after his name? Do you want to be the guy that everybody says, he's not legitimate. He was appointed by an unindicted co-conspirator president, and they hid, you know, large chunks of his past. And Kavanaugh's actually got this look on his face like, maybe you got something there. So who knows? I mean, he's basically appealing to his vanity. And Blumenthal, the bizarre back and forth with Grassley about, you know, well, the rules say that if I call for a vote and we have a vote, then we get to take a break. And if the majority votes for it, and Grassley's like, I'm not going to hold that vote. Nope, it ain't going to happen. It's pretty amazing. Dave in Buffalo, New York, listening on SiriusXM. Hey, Dave, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Can you hear me? I'm on the bus.
Just fine.
Okay, thank you. As the Kavanaugh proceedings move forward and it goes to a vote eventually, if the Democratic senators aren't in Washington, D.C. at all, because the Capitol Police can bring them to D.C., to the Capitol to take a vote, if they're not in D.C. at all, from the time the vote goes until after the primary or in the general, then the vote for Kavanaugh can't take place because the Democratic senators aren't in office to hold the vote. Is that possible? Yes or no? I don't know.
I think no. I believe that a quorum for the Senate is a simple majority, and so they would only have to have 50 people there, and there are 50 Republicans right now, minus John McCain. Sorry. And Doug Ducey, or Governor Ducey, just put John Kyle, the former Arizona senator, back on the Senate until, you know, in John McCain's place. They're probably going to swear him in today or tomorrow. He's only going to serve until December, until there's a more, you know, long-term pick. I think, frankly, Meghan McCain should have gotten that seat. But in any case, so that they'll be back to 51 votes. I mean, this is all about partisan politics, Dave. But I'm quite sure I'm right about that. So I don't think that's going to work. It worked in Wisconsin, but they had slightly different rules there. Natano in Hood River, Oregon. Hey, Natano, what's up?
Hey, Tom. I think a meme we should start going with is Robert's Radical Puritans, because these guys aren't conservative. They're radical Puritans that want to take this country back to the 50s, you know, the 1650s.
Yeah, exactly. I was just going to say the 1750s. Yeah, exactly. Maybe the 1850s, but yeah, I'm with you.
Yeah, because, I mean, I asked Greg Walden one time at a town hall meeting. I said, okay, are you a conservative? And he went on about how he was a proud conservative, and he was as conservative as you could get. And I said, can you name one thing you conserve? And I pointed out, thanks to your I've been listening to you a long time. So I said, and one thing you repeat, and hardly enough, is the Republicans haven't balanced a budget since the 1950s. And I said that. And he just looked at me like, he just gave me this death stare for about 20 seconds, didn't say a thing. But
yeah.
People need to ask the conservative or so-called conservative, you know, these Republicans, what they conserve at every town hall meeting they go to. Because when you ask them that and you point out the fact that they're not fiscally conservative, then the only thing left is radical Puritans.
Yeah,
and you know, they are activists. They're very aggressive, and they, you know, they want to, you know, democracy is something we have to maintain. You know, it's not something that's just going to be static. And these guys are you know, taking advantage of the fact that most people just think it's static and can never move.
Oh, and they about every 80 years they come around and they do it over again, over and over again. Natana, well said. And by the way, to put a pin in this, I just got this email. I mean, literally, just in the last hour, from Credo Action, you know, the progressive group that does cell phones and things. And the tell Republicans, keep your hands off Social Security and Medicare. Representative Steve Stivers, he's a Wall Street lackey, Republican congressman. He's in charge of reelecting members, the House of Representatives, Republicans. He just proudly confessed that the tax cuts for corporations and the ultra rich would be paid for by slashing Social Security and Medicare. Just came right out and said this. John Harwood did a report on CNBC titled, "A Leading Republican Urges Reform for Medicare and Social Security as Deficits Balloon Under the GOP Tax Cut." Before the Republican tax scam, Paul Ryan said, you know, next year we're going to have to get back here on entitlement reform. They're using the deficit that they created to say we can't afford to have Social Security and Medicare anymore. Senator Tom Cole, the Republican from Oklahoma. Someone wants to get serious about debt, come talk to me about entitlements, Social Security and Medicare. John Thune, Senator from South Dakota or North Dakota, one of the Dakotas. He says, if we're going to do something about spending and debt, we have to take on making our entitlement programs more sustainable. I think there's support here generally for entitlement reform. Entitlement reform is Republican speak for cutting Social Security, cutting Medicare. That's what these guys are up to. Greg in Reno, Nevada. Hey, Greg, thanks for listening to us at 9:10 a.m. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Thank you for taking my call. I'm a first-time caller, and I have a question. It's as to the court packing during FDR's administration.
Sure.
And when I was in college, and at the time, history books, et cetera, it conveyed, and based upon those articles and footnotes and various history books, is that FDR did not have the support of moderate or conservative Dems, and of course, the GOP at that time, and that there was a book that was written, I haven't read it, in all fairness, it's called Supreme Power by Jeff Sechal, if I pronounce his name correctly, mentioning even that FDR's VP at the time went on into the Senate and did various gestures saying that he was against the FDR's plan as well. Could you, with what you had mentioned earlier, my long version here is, could you provide me with other information as to what your interpretation is that he
sure
would have been successful?
There was a book that I read. There's a fair amount of stuff in my book, The Crash of 2016, about FDR, and I went back and read newspaper archives from 1932 all the way through 1938, and there is a book, and I'm sorry, I wrote that book in 2014, and which was 4 years ago, 5 years ago, and I don't remember the title of the book, but I read it, and right, it was specifically about FDR's court packing scheme, and okay, the point that the author...
I'm sorry, but you don't know you can't recall the name of the book.
I'm sorry, I can't. I'm okay. Sure it'll come up real easily if you do a search.
Is your book Crash of 2016?
I refer to it in my book, The Crash of 2016.
Okay.
It might be in the endnotes or the index there.
Yeah, good.
But in fact, I've got a copy right here. I'll pull it out while we're talking. But anyhow, the point that he made was that this was never before the legislature. FDR threatened it, but they never dropped the legislation, and so as a result, we really don't know. And it has been Republican legend that FDR was way outside the mainstream, blah, 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 blah. But the fact of the matter is, if it wasn't real and possible and, in fact, probable, in all probability, the Supreme Court justices would not have made the highly political decision. And I'm looking at the book and I don't see court packing in here, so maybe it's FDR court packing. They would not have made the decision to change their whole political thing. So... maybe it's under R for Roosevelt. In any case, I'm sorry, I can't. Yeah, here it is. Oh, there's just all kinds of stuff here. You're gonna have, you know, it's, if you've got the book, I can't ask people to just hold, you know, while I'm looking through my own book. But it's out there. It's fairly easy to find. And the fact is that we don't know right now, you know, whether he would have succeeded or not. But this book made the case that he would have, and made the argument that several other books that were written in the 50s and 60s that said he wouldn't have were making, and then said that this is why they were wrong. Greg, I'll have to poke around and see what I can come up with. I'll try to mention it on the radio in the next day or two if I can find it. Randy in Twin Cities, Minnesota. Hey, Randy, thanks for listening to KTNF. What's up? Randy, you are on the air here.
Yep, thank you. Earlier, you had a caller call in about that we really need to vote for Democrats, and no matter what, that's what has to happen. He was complaining about the purity test and that that's a big problem. And you kind of agreed with him, but just before that guy came on, you were talking to another caller to call five senators.
Right.
Murkowski and Collins and three what?
Three Democrats.
Democrats.
Yeah.
So it's just, it does matter. It's not blue no matter, because that's exactly why we're where we are.
No, but the fact of the matter is that you would not be able to call Joe Manchin or Claire McCaskill or Heidi Heitkamp and lobby them Democrat to Democrat right now if they hadn't run in those states as Democrats. Now, I'm frankly of the opinion that had they run as genuine progressives, that they would actually have more power in those states. But I could be wrong.
Right.
And the fact of the matter is that's who they're there, and they are holding those positions. And you know, I'm, you know, they're there. Right? If we're talking a primary, it's a whole different conversation. But you know, right now you've got three quote moderate Democrats in the United States Senate who could be swung on this vote. And we need to be calling them, and we need to call every single senator. And the number is 202-224-3121 to get you to the switchboard for the Senate. It's 45 minutes past the hour.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Back with more of your calls right after this. It's coming up on 46 F. And welcome back. Carolyn and her. Hearn, Texas. Am I saying that right, Carolyn, watching Free Speech TV?
Yes, you are.
Hey, what's up?
Well, I'm actually going to change the subject a little bit from the Supreme Court to your discussion about the revolution. And I'd like to suggest that instead of revolting for war, that we, as the people, mobilize for democracy, and that we use our 10th Amendment right to change from a representative republic to a participatory republic.
Meaning what? Do you want to go back to like the Greek polis where you've got to have 6,000 people to have a vote?
Well, no, I think that we could do it using our Constitution the way it is, and that every representative has to vote the will of his constituents.
Determine how? I mean, that's the theory right now, and the way that it's determined is they reelect those persons.
Yes, but they go to the seat of government and do whatever they want.
If the people don't want them doing that, the people vote them out 2 years later. I mean, the House of Representatives has 100% turnover every 2 years.
Well, no,
or the potential for 100% turnover. Excuse me.
We reelect them every two years. They don't turn over.
Yeah, you're right. I corrected myself.
But what we could do is that we could use the .gov site. We could use the .gov site and set up a special page for constituents only, where we could go in and we could look at all the legislation. We could ask questions. We could debate, and then registered voters could go and vote for proposed legislation. Making us a true democracy, the first one in this country.
So what you're arguing for is having at the federal level the referendum kind of system that you have at the state level in so many of the Western states.
Well, no, if we're going to be a democracy, then the will of the people should be listened to. And right now, it is not the will of the people, it's the will of corporations.
Right, but the question then becomes why? And I mean, why is it that we've lost the ability of the people to govern, you know, through a representative system? And I would say it's because I think that we've had it more or less, a lot more in the past than we have right now. And I think it's that the Supreme Court has ruled that it's okay for billionaires to buy politicians and to buy elections with unlimited campaign spending. And that, you know, whether you've got an elected representative system or whether you've got a national referendum system. I mean, here in Oregon, they passed legislation, or we passed referendums. The citizens voted on referendums that changed our Constitution to say that if the state has a budget, that they have to write checks and send all that money back to the taxpayers rather than hang on to it for a rainy day fund, which has just kneecapped the state in a lot of ways from doing anything progressive. They passed that because they, a bunch of rich people, spent a fortune on getting it passed.
Yes, but if the people tell the Congress how to vote, then that eliminates...
But this was the people. My point is that the people are going to respond to what they're told. If you've got billionaires pouring hundreds of millions of dollars into campaigns, right now the Koch brothers putting $400 million into the midterms to make sure that there's no blue wave. And I'm very concerned that they're going to have success. I mean, when you have that, it's really, really hard to have anything that resembles a democracy, which is why Jimmy Carter on this program said, we're no longer a democracy, we're an oligarchy. Carolyn, I get what you're saying, and I love the idea. I love the concept behind it. Welcome back. Tom in San Diego. Whoops. Hang on just a second, Tom. There we go. Tom in San Diego, California, watching us on Facebook Live. Hey, Tom, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Thanks so much for taking my call.
My pleasure. It's on your mind.
So lots of women vote for Republicans, which at least in part led to the GOP's majority in the House, the Senate.
Right. 53% of white women voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah, exactly. And ultimately, it led to this Kavanaugh hearing. So again, in part. So I would love to hear your take on why women and a lot of people in general continue to vote for candidates who counter their own interests. And is it simply that they're misinformed or uninformed? And if that is the case, then how can we as progressives do better to, A, get people who don't ordinarily vote out to the polls this November, and B, convince those who do vote to vote for progressive candidates who truly do have the people's interests at heart?
Yeah. I think what's been going on here, Tom, I'm sorry. I think what's been going on here is that a lot of us have been basically sleepwalking. And I mentioned earlier the Susan Sarandon scenario. You know, Susan Sarandon had come out and said, well, I'm not going to vote for Hillary Clinton. And, and everybody was like, that's crazy. You're going to end up with Donald Trump as president. And she said, where's the effect of, well, if that happens, that'll wake the country up. And they damn well need, a cold splash in the face. We've got it. We got that cold splash in the face. And I don't think that Trump or the Republicans are going to carry 53% of the white women vote again. And I apologize that I don't remember what I'm not sure I ever knew what the percentage of the white male vote was in the election, but presumably it was larger than 53%, for Trump. But I think that what's happening is people are being radicalized by the radicality or radicalness, I guess, of the guy in the White House. And Bob Woodward's book is going to be feeding that as well. I mean, we had Michael Wolff for a while, then we had Omarosa, now it's Bob Woodward. It's like these things kind of go in cycles. But that's what I think is going on. Phil in Minneapolis, Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hey, Phil, what's up?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Well, to answer a question you asked an earlier caller, what do Republicans ever conserve? They conserve poor people's money in the pockets of rich people and rich corporations.
Excellent point. Well,
concerning Kavanaugh, he is of a piece. He's like a judicial clone of Neil Gorsuch,
yep.
whose famous hearing, he was questioned by former Senator Al Franken of Minnesota about why he felt that an employee of a corporation should have to stay with a truck that had no heater and freeze to death in 20 below zero weather to wait for a repair person. And Gorsuch said, because that's his job.
Right.
So I suppose, judging from what the little bit of Kavanaugh's record that's been revealed to the public, he would believe that if a corporation can control your job to the point of you having to die rather than take a life-saving measure that would preserve your life, and therefore you could work for the corporation, continue working for the corporation, you're supposed to do what would kill you, because that's what the corporation's rules say you should do.
Well, and to add to that, by the way, Trump just in the last day or so has cut back on workplace safety regulations, or maybe the last week.
Yeah, of course.
This is like
why should anybody have to be required to provide a reasonable degree of safety for their employees when they can make an extra nickel or dime an hour
yep.
from that person? Because after all, profit is more important than
than people.
Well, it's like...
it's more important... Like,
yeah, people who argue that the Republicans don't believe in socialism, they believe in corporate socialism.
Oh,
they
big
believe
time.
In military socialism.
And Bernie Sanders and, oh, geez, who's on Mondays, who comes on and takes calls? Ro Khanna, that's right, thank you.
Oh.
Brain fart. Bernie Sanders and Ro Khanna just introduced legislation this morning. And it's called the End Corporate Socialism and Welfare Act, or words to that effect.
Sounds wonderful. And
yeah, yeah. So step by step. Phil, I want to get a couple more calls in here before the end of the show. Thank you so much for calling. Gene in Sonoma County, California. Hey, Gene, you want to talk about court packing?
Hey. Yeah. Hey, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Kirsten Downey wrote a book, and you're familiar with it, The Woman That Created the New Deal.
Yeah.
On Francis Perkins. Okay,
yes.
Inside there's a whole thing on this court packing thing.
Oh, then that's the book that I read.
Oh, okay. Anyway, the law didn't pass, but there was no need to. She understood that these guys, and they were making overtures to her, secret, you know, kind of wink, wink, nod, nod,
mm-hmm.
get me a raise, make sure my pension comes through. And she was invited to one of the justices' evening dinners or something.
Right.
And it's mentioned in the book. And anyway, the law eventually passes that they get guaranteed pensions, and then boom, three of these guys retire. FDR gets to put in who he wants, and all was good with the world after that.
Yeah, yeah.
So I highly recommend people read that book also. And then
you are absolutely right. And for the caller who wanted to know what the book was, that was the book. That you're right. It was a whole chapter in that book, and it was the book about Francis Perkins. Is that her name?
She basically, yeah. She reminded me so much of last night. I saw CNN's RBG.
I saw that too. Louise and I watched that. That was great.
Just blows me away how close their backgrounds match up. But that's what I wanted to say.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thanks, Tom.
Thanks for the call. And let's see here. Bernice, we have half a minute. Bernice, you got a quick one for us?
Half a minute. Yes, I was just wanted to respond to the guy that was asking why white women, you know, vote for
right.
someone like Trump that's not in, you know.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's because of the white privilege thing. Because you know, whites are not comfortable with still voting. They deep down, Tom, this is deep down. You know, you have.
Beatrice, Bernice, I'm sorry, it's the end of the show, so I've got to run. But yeah, I think you're absolutely right. I think, you know, kind of a neo-tribalism, you know, among white people is more important than, you know, important values like, you know, should abortion be available or should we have Social Security? Anyhow, don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It requires you. Get out there, get active. Congress, 202-224-3121. I'll see you tomorrow. Tag, you're it.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.